Welcome once again to Word on the Hills with me, Felicity Sidnell-Reed, and my co-host, Gwen Sheltimer. This week, we're doing something a little different. Because it's the holiday season, we asked local writers to share stories and poems about the Christmas season. Some will make you laugh, perhaps some will make you cry, and some might jog memories of your own Christmases, past and present. Consider it our gift from Word on the Hills to you. What are we starting with, Gwen?
Well, I'm going to start with a piece that I think evokes the true spirit of giving at Christmas time. I know that many people feel anxious about the pressure to spend money and buy gifts, but this story is about giving a gift that costs only love. The piece is from Diane Taylor, a memoirist and teacher of memoir writing, right here in Northumberland County. Here she is to share it with you.
On the occasion of my father's 77th birthday, I wanted to do something especially meaningful for him. Who knew how many more birthdays he would have? I'd been his daughter for 51 of those years. At the time, I was having a rough time surviving in Toronto as a supply teacher, teaching grade 9 French and adult English as a second language at a Scarborough high school, and feeling like an alien in Canada when I really wanted to be back in the Caribbean with my tribe. My attention was on preparing lessons for the next day, still trying to stay sane in spite of the loss of my family there. And at the time, Dad and I were not seeing eye to eye. For a while, I was on unemployment insurance, living at home. I wanted to borrow his car to drive to the unemployment office 20 miles away, and he said no. We were quick to flare up at each other. Then we weren't talking. He was so distraught by this that he consulted a therapist. I was distraught too, but too busy to deal with it head on. I decided to write him a long thank you letter for all the things, material and of the spirit, that he had given me over the years. I bought a new pen. I bought special paper, yellow because that was his favorite color. Early December, a month before his birthday, I sat down one evening with this pen and paper at my desk. I sat and thought. I wrote, "Thank you." I looked out the window at the tumbling yellow maple leaves, my mind a blank. I didn't know it was going to be this difficult. Then something shifted and I focused more on him, pointed at him with my mind, you could say. I wrote, "Thank you for giving me your love of words." A few memories had come to me about the stories he used to tell with great Irish gusto. Then my mind jumped back to how he had supported me as a proud father during my years as a teacher. I wrote, "Thank you for the leather briefcase my first year teaching. I still have it and keep special things in it." I wrote surprisingly little in the hour I had set aside, just those two things. The next night I set aside the same hour and sat with the same yellow paper at the same desk and picked up the same pen. I pulled my mind away from the day into the space I had created for my father. I wrote down three more things: teaching me to drive, to plant a tree, to not fear thunder. It was a little strange to be thinking about my father's earlier years, making him, not me, the focus. It felt like opening a door to a room I seldom visited and peering in. During spare moments the next day, I found that I was occasionally thinking about what I could say. In subsequent days, I looked forward to adding to my list of memories. There was an excitement to bringing dormant images to life. I saw him drying my long red hair on Sunday afternoons with that pink hairdryer, singing in his off-key voice when I played Christmas carols, working all those years at a job he didn't like to support his family. After a couple of weeks, the memories poured in. I filled up page 1, page 2, page 3, each with about 25 gifts, then filled up pages 4 and 5. I was becoming awake and aware to his lifespan. It was now a span of memories. Before I knew it, his birthday was upon me, and I had to quickly finish the letter. I folded my work and placed it inside the card. Dad was no longer as quick as he once was. I wondered what his response would be. Silently, he read through them all. Then he looked up, his gravelly voice carefully enunciating, "It's all here."
What a lovely idea. I know I would be thrilled to receive such a letter. And now we have an entirely different piece from Anthony DiNardo. Anthony is the author of 5 books of poetry, but this time he has a short story for us.
The Night of the Christmas Witch by Anthony DiNardo. Read for you this afternoon by Chris Cameron. Tim is thinking about Christmas Eve and the night not long ago when he first set eyes on the Christmas witch. She lived in the gingerbread trailer just a block up from the marina, surrounded by the festive evergreens the town had strategically placed to keep the spirit of the season alive and her little home hidden from view. Some locals likened it to a fairy tale forest smack in the middle of town. Christmas camouflage, others said. That's all it is. It was common knowledge that a witch could turn on you at any time. Tim had just moved to town, occupying a modest unit overlooking the bell tower of the old city hall. His neighbor, a retired lighthouse keeper, talked about the times he saw her up in the belfry under the arches, brushing her hair, chasing the cobwebs away, about how the children were warned away from her, describing her broom and shoes, hat and cape, as possessed by her magic, how she frightened the elderly with look-alike mirrors and tales of the future. The Christmas Eve Tim saw her, she was at the door of the gingerbread trailer with a broom in her hands, sweeping the snow from her step. The trailer was tucked away among the trees, like it didn't even exist. Actually, most of the townspeople had forgotten where it was she lived. Tonight, however, since it was Christmas Eve, and as tradition would have it, she put on the wig she had carefully brushed back into shape, got into her warm winter wrap, straightened her back, and readied herself for the walk to the houses in town she knew she would visit before the end of the night. As she tightened the wrap around her shoulders and walked off her step, the clock tower struck 9, and she knew it was time, her one night of the year, to go into the world where everyone else lived. Tim followed her that night. The wind blew in short, relentless gasps. The air was cold and icy. But she didn't seem to mind. Both heard the muffled sounds of evergreens that groaned and creaked under the weight of the snow on their boughs. Both saw the shreds and patches of ice on the sidewalk, snapping and crackling. He watched her cross the road and waited to see which way she would go. The old witch turned and walked up to the first house at the far end of the road. The house glistened with bright strings of light under the eaves, and a giant electric candle beamed at the door. But it was the large living room window that caught her attention and drew the witch closer. She peered through the glass, her nose almost touching the window. She stared at the marvelous tree in the corner, heavy with ornaments. A little girl stood at the tree, fondling an angel that hung from a branch. The witch knew she would be seen and what to expect of her magic. Just as the thought crossed her mind, she heard words spoken by the girl, who pointed to the window and said, "Look, Mommy, it's Aunt Mary. She's here." And the little girl waved, her face all lit up. But her mother saw nothing at all. At the next house, the old witch walked up to the kitchen window and looked in to see steam rising from pots on the stove, the counters cluttered with dishes and knives, a young woman half hidden behind the refrigerator door. When the woman turned, she smiled, staring at the face framed by the kitchen curtain. "Grandma," she said, "is it really you?" But when she went to the door to let her in, no one was there, only the snow falling, gentle and soft. A few steps away, she came to a house with hundreds of lights strung on branches and wrapped around a barren tree. The lights seemed to flicker and sway to the voices she heard coming from inside the house. A bristling chandelier hung above a table she saw through the dining room window. Dinner had been served, the plates and glasses half empty, the guests talking and laughing, paper hats on their heads. At one end of the table, an old man sat, wistful and quiet, staring into emptiness, lost in his thoughts. When he saw her standing at the window, their eyes locked and his face brightened. "Audrey," he said out loud, "you've come back." But as soon as he got up from his chair, she was gone. He hurried to the door and opened it, looking everywhere for the woman in gray he'd seen at the window. However, since a witch can hide in plain sight, she was nowhere to be found. The old witch went from house to house, cottage to cottage, and she was twice a grandmother, and twice an aunt, and once a well-loved neighbor. She was a best friend several times over, and many times someone's sister. Widowers called her by name, and children begged her to come and sit with them and join the celebrations. but the old witch came and went just as quickly as she was seen. Snowflakes spun in the shimmer and sparkle of tiny lights, and as the bell in the clock tower struck midnight, Tim watched as the old witch returned to her gingerbread trailer, leaving only boot prints in the snow, until she reached her door and disappeared from sight.
Thanks, Chris. Now we need to take a short break, but before we do, here's a fun little poem my grandchildren taught me. It's called Snowball by Shel Silverstein. I made myself a snowball as perfect as could be. I thought I'd keep it as a pet and let it sleep with me. I made it some pajamas and a pillow for its head. Then last night it ran away, but first it wet the bed. And now we'll take a short break.